And we're back. It's the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. And by the way, you can write to us, check us out on the web, taylor-report.com. You can write it to us, taylor@ciut.fm. And I believe we are joined by Stephen Gowans. Are you there, sir?
I am. Hello.
Stephen, you have been on the ball here, writing a little more than usual. You seem to be picking up the signals that something ugly might be unfolding with this Syria business. And you've taken the line that there is no demonstrated evidence, et cetera, and yet the President of the United States has introduced a phrase, the red line. Can you tell me what's a red line, and where does he get what legal capacity does he have to be telling someone in Syria how to conduct their affairs?
Yeah, he has absolutely none.
None.
None at all. All he has is, I suppose, the power of the gun,
mm-hmm.
or of Tomahawk cruise missiles.
Mm-hmm.
No. It's all very interesting. I know that there are probably three questions that have been conflated and should be separated about this issue. So maybe I can mm-hmm. mention them. The three questions are, does Syria have the right to use chemical weapons?
Mm-hmm.
Were chemical weapons used last week? And was the Syrian government responsible for their use if indeed they were used? And if you ask someone like Barack Obama or the Foreign Secretary of Britain, William Hague, or French officials, they'll give you an answer of yes to each of those questions. Sorry, not yes. So, for example, they'll say no, Syria does not have the right to use chemical weapons. Yes, we believe chemical weapons were used last week, and yes, it's obvious that the Syrian government is responsible. But I think that they're wrong on all three counts. On the first count, does Syria have the right to use chemical weapons? Well, there's no legal obligation for it to refrain from using chemical weapons. So there's this international convention that bans the use of chemical weapons, but you have to belong to the convention. You have to agree to it.
Mm-hmm.
Syria hasn't agreed to it. So Syria hasn't relinquished its right to use chemical weapons. Neither, significantly, have the United States two major subalterns in the Middle East, Egypt and mm-hmm. Israel.
Mm-hmm.
Israel has failed to ratify the convention, although it's expressed interest in signing on. Egypt refuses to sign on. So Syria has a formal legal right to use chemical weapons
mm-hmm.
and to do so with impunity. You could also argue that it has the right to use whatever weapons it needs to defend itself against the neo-colonial designs of the United States and the former colonial powers of Britain and France. And then there's also an issue you can get into about why is it that your weapons of mass destruction are all right, but mine aren't?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Tomahawk cruise missiles. I mean, how much damage can a Tomahawk cruise missile create? I mean, it can create massive damage. And it's likely that if they're used, I mean, it has the potential to kill far more people than have actually been killed in all the alleged chemical weapons attack incidents that have occurred in Syria to date.
Mm-hmm.
So there's that. The second issue is, were chemical weapons actually used last week? Well, no one seems to really know for sure that they were.
Mm-hmm.
And there's been a lot of talk about, well, you know, the White House is trying to ascertain the facts. As of 2 days ago, the State Department was saying, we don't really know. The New York Times was saying, yeah, it seems like that there were lots of people dead, but there's an allegation that chemical weapons were used, but there's no proof that that's the case.
Mm-hmm.
You can argue, however, that there's mounting evidence that chemical weapons were used. But still, I mean, the case hasn't been established.
Mm-hmm.
But there's this neat little trick that Washington and the United and France and Britain are trying to play. And the trick is that if we establish that chemical weapons were used, that we've also established that the Syrian government has used them,
mm-hmm.
which is the third question. I mean, you can establish that they've been used, but that doesn't tell you who's used them. And interestingly, I mean, months and months ago, when the United States didn't want to become embroiled in Syria, and there were allegations that the Syrian government had used chemical weapons, you could see these very detailed and very careful analyses in the New York Times, for example, about what you needed to do to establish whether, in fact, chemical weapons had been used, what you needed to do to establish whether, in fact, they'd been used by a particular party. And all of that has been thrown out the window. Now all of these evidentiary standards really don't matter anymore. And as of yesterday, what the United States and Britain and France are saying is, you know, we don't have to prove that the Assad government used chemical weapons. The standard now is that unless the Syrian government can prove itself innocent, it must be guilty.
Hmm.
I mean, that's the standard. And if you think about it, that's exactly what the United States did in Iraq and is doing today in Iran.
Yes.
I mean, the Iraqis were required to prove that they had no weapons of mass destruction. And their inability to prove that negative provided the U.S.-led coalition with the pretext to bomb and sanction. Today in Iran, the Iranians are required to prove they don't have a nuclear weapons program, you know, even though U.S. intelligence says they don't, even though the International Atomic Energy Agency inspectors have no evidence that nuclear material is being diverted to military use. All the same, the country is being subjected to, you know, a propaganda campaign, to economic strangulation, to military intimidation,
mm-hmm.
and they're required to prove that they're innocent. And you have to prove that you're innocent simply because we say you're guilty. And we offer no evidence that we are guilty. We simply say you're guilty. So if you can't prove you're innocent, you must be guilty.
Yes. I just have to throw in there. I recently was reading this piece by Chomsky where he pointed out that with Osama bin Laden, of course, they never did prove that he had done anything. And they killed him, went into Pakistan with a secret commando group, killed him and threw his body in the ocean. We are dealing with people, you know, from a distance might appear crazy.
Yes.
And by the way, incidentally, the only explanation they have for the behavior of Mr. Assad, I noticed in your article, is that they're arguing that he's insane. But I see quite a bit of insane conduct on their side of the picture. But you point out there's absolutely no motivation here for the Syrian government to be doing this, particularly at this time.
Right. I mean, and they always do this. They always come up with these silly stories that, I mean, are full of holes. They're just ridiculous stories. And you say the only way this story can hold together is if we believe that the people the stories are about are either crazy or completely stupid.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, when you say that the Syrian government used chemical weapons, I mean, why would they use a weapon of mass destruction to produce limited casualties,
mm-hmm.
a few hundred?
Yeah.
Why would they use gas against civilians and not against armed rebels? I mean, apparently that's the threat, armed rebels, not civilians. Why
yes.
would they launch an attack at the same time there are inspectors in the country to investigate chemical weapons use? That would seem to be the absolute worst time to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And why would you handle, or rather hand, political enemies a pretext to step up their military intervention? I mean, especially when, you know, you're not, what is it that you're going to gain by using chemical weapons? There's very little that they're gaining, very little that you would gain by killing a few hundred civilians. So why would you try to secure those limited gains and at the same time take the immense risk of handing your political enemies a pretext to intervene more forcefully in your country? None of this makes any sense. And I mean, only if the Syrian government was riddled with morons, you might believe the story.
Mm-hmm.
But it's obviously not a government of of morons. I mean, it's hung on for 3 years against armed rebels backed by royal dictators, backed by former colonial powers, backed by history's top imperialist power. And they've obviously done so with a certain amount of perspicacity and knowing when to avoid suicidal missteps. So this argument doesn't make any sense.
By the way, the Syrian president, if anybody took the time to read the text of his speeches or see the interviews he's given, is a very careful man. The way he talks, he doesn't engage in the kind of a rhetoric, inflammatory rhetoric of the Western leaders, which we're not allowed to mention usually. That's why we're talking to you on CIUT at 9.5 FM. But I mean, we're not even allowed to notice this. Our editorial writers don't tell us that he appears to be quite rational. And he also appears to want a negotiated resolution, is committed to this thing called the Geneva process, Geneva 1. And I noticed the Russian ambassador said that, you know, we were scheduled to have Geneva 2, but obviously we're not going to have it for a while because of this conduct.
Yeah, and I know there's been talk about from the side of the rebels in the U.S. of, well, we're not going to have these talks. We can't have these talks now. We're not in a strong enough position to have these talks.
We need a level playing field.
Really not interested in it.
I mentioned this is Stephen Gowans. It's gowans.wordpress.com, and excellent pieces, and they've been very up-to-date. I noticed something you cited, which is, I want to know your thoughts about. You quote, pardon me, the Washington Post, I think, quotes a rebel leader whom the Washington Post identifies as an al-Qaeda fighter from Iraq. And he says, well, it's going to be eye for an eye. We're going to use the same weapons on them that they've used on, you know, suggesting he has chemical weapons. And well, I guess here's the bottom. Here's the part two of that is it appears to that the U.S. administration actually is positioning itself where it doesn't. They're going to say it doesn't matter which of you is using it. We're going to come in because we understand that an illegal product is being used in this war. Is that the impression you get?
Yeah. Well, it's not illegal in Syria because no one in Syria has agreed that you can't use chemical weapons. Yeah. So this is kind of an arbitrary and unilateral decision then made by the United States. What I find really aggravating, though, is the arguments made by people like the British Foreign Secretary William Hague that, well, it's impossible that anyone but the Syrian government could be using chemical weapons in Syria. Because there's so much evidence to suggest that the Syrian government doesn't have a monopoly on their use. Everyone seems to forget about the United Nations Independent Commission of Inquiry on Syria, which in May said to reporters that the commission had gathered some evidence that chemical weapons had been used by the opponents, by the rebels.
Yes, that's Carlo Del Ponte, one of their favorite prosecutors.
Yes.
She's sort of fallen out of favor, I know. Incidentally, Stephen, I better ask you this. They've been bragging all weekend about their meetings, about how they've been calling each other, the prime minister, the president. I notice that Merkel doesn't seem to be in the circle. Is there a problem there? Or is it she's a woman? I don't know.
I understand that she's a little bit more cautious about this. The other thing about the meetings they've had, if you look at the U.S. State Department's statements up to this point, or up to the meetings, they always are, well, we don't know what the facts are. We're trying to ascertain the facts. We don't know what they are. And then suddenly we hear from the U.S. Secretary of State, well, now we know the Syrian government has done it. And yet there's no effort to show us what proof, what evidence they have to suggest that it did. And that's because, of course, they seem to have decided that they're not going to have any evidence. They're simply going to declare that the Syrians must be guilty. They can't prove they're innocent. They must be guilty.
Yes. I don't see, of course, in our parliament any clamor, certainly in the United States Congress, both these places run by zombies, apparently. There's nobody says a word Mr. Kucinich is no longer in the U.S. Congress. I presume he might have. Well, maybe the Tea Party guy, I forget, from Kentucky, but he doesn't count, I think. But another matter I want to make sure I call attention to. Now, again, we're speaking to Stephen Gowans, gowans.wordpress.com, and there's some very recent articles by Stephen that people should be reading. You've been trying to be helpful for a long time on the issue of what a proper view from the left would be, and you out a couple of people in your article. You mentioned that Patrick Cockburn, who is not Alex, I notice, seems to be kind of going along with this, and then other people you simply identify as leftists who are buying into the argument. And you said they ought to read Mr. Gramsci on hegemony, since that's probably not at everybody's fingertips. Could you tell us what you're speaking of when you mention invoke Gramsci there?
Well, that's the idea that people absorb the ideas or the ideology of the dominant class, or in this case, you know, it would be people like the dominant ideas of, as expressed by William Hague, the British Foreign Secretary. I mean, there's certain ways of thinking and speaking, certain language, certain concepts that you use. Even the idea of weapons of mass destruction, if you think about it, is not necessarily an idea that perhaps the left should be embracing. What do we mean by weapons of mass destruction? Weapons of mass destruction are used to have a political meaning, because when we say gas is a weapon of mass destruction, but cruise missiles aren't, what are we implying? We were implying that countries like Syria can't use gas, but countries like the United States can use far more destructive weapons like cruise missiles or, you know, advanced jet fighters, attack helicopters, and the like.
Mm-hmm.
But even this idea about, which seems to be accepted, that if we demonstrate that chemical weapons have been used in Syria, that it implies necessarily that those chemical weapons were used by the Syrian government, is something that seems to have been embraced by large parts of the West.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, they might say things like, oh, well, look at Patrick Cockburn. He's a very reliable reporter, and he says in a recent
yes.
article that
yes.
There's mounting evidence that the Syrians have gassed their people. Well, what mounting evidence he's presented? When you look at his article, the mounting evidence is, looks like gas was used in this. He doesn't address the question of, yeah, so what? Gas mm-hmm. was used, but who used it?
Mm-hmm.
In doing that, he's essentially accepted is propagating the argument that's been put forth by William Hague and others. You know, if we can prove that gas has been used, then that must mean that Assad is guilty.
Mm-hmm. It seems to be, of course, it's the impression I get is they understand that it has a sensational quality to it. To use a kind of the expression sarin, and of course there's the memories of World War I. But you point out in your article, of course, that these weapons actually are not very good, and it doesn't make sense. It's being used, in this case, civilians. They try to turn... the original number was below 300, and now zealous and diligent work by a bunch of lying reporters has turned it into 1,300. But that's still, we're not talking about a weapon of any great value. It hasn't, no one's claimed that the battlefield has been altered dramatically in any degree by these things that they're referring to.
Yeah, and those estimates of the number of deaths are all over the place, from 20 to over 1,000 to, if Doctors Without Borders say it's something like 330.
Pardon me for interrupting, but I realize I've got to ask you about the Doctors Without Borders. Suddenly, they're on the front pages. I notice several commentators who write in the Middle East and follow this have very unhappy with Doctors Without Borders. They said, here they had a reputation for being humanitarian, but they seem to want to be a part of the political debate. And whereas in the past they would say, well, we don't know. And by the way, the bottom line is they're still saying they don't know. It's just that they want you to know that they think it's the Syrian government. But who the heck is Doctors Without Borders? Can you tell me? You know, there used to be the Red Cross. I remember when the Red Cross got pushed aside, and they said, "Well, that's not the, we don't want the Red Cross around. They're too political. We want this vague group called Doctors Without Borders," the leader of which later went on to become a minister in the Sarkozy's government.
Yes. Yes.
I want the Red Cross back, by the way. But anyway, could you tell us who you think they are?
Well, I mean, no, that's, you're right. I mean, they are linked to the foreign policy establishment of Western governments. But if you read the report, they say, oh, well, you know, this many were killed. We believe that they were killed by a neurotoxin, but we have no idea who carried out the attack.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, they're still being cited as somehow this is proof that the Syrian government carried out a chemical weapons attack, when indeed, if you read the report, Doctors Without Borders said, we have no idea who carried out the attack.
Yeah, and but they don't become, their feelings are not hurt when they see their names being invoked in the front pages and lending themselves to an attack. The way Amnesty International, we all remember that Amnesty appeared at a congressional hearing, and they produced a nurse who said she saw Kuwaiti babies being thrown out of incubators, and she turned out to be the daughter of the Emir of Kuwait, I think.
Yeah,
the nurse.
The ambassador to the U.S.
Amnesty. Shouldn't we have a kind of a rule? You don't get to testify for a while because you brought a phony?
Well, even not too many years. It led in the last 2 years, I think, that Amnesty International came out with a high-profile report about North Korea and its terrible healthcare system, which made absolutely no mention of the fact that North Korea is the most heavily sanctioned country in the world. And that has considerable, or has had a considerable impact on the North Koreans' ability to provide health care to their citizens.
Mm-hmm.
But it's almost like criminally ignorant. To make these points about North Korea without, in fact, pointing to this very significant fact.
Mm-hmm.
But getting back to the question of gas, gas. There's a reason why gas isn't widely used. It's because it's not very efficient. It's messy. It's difficult to use. Its effects are very unpredictable. The United States doesn't use gas because it has far more effective in certain ways to slaughter large numbers of people.
Yeah.
So it can demonize gas, you know, the weapon it doesn't need.
Mm-hmm.
But countries with with less military prowess, they might find gas useful. And then they brand, you know, far more destructive weapons with the potential to create mass destruction as acceptable. So they've established this double standard that says, you know, our weapons of mass destruction, which we don't call weapons of mass destruction, are acceptable, but yours, which we do, are not.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's really absurd here. This is great absurdity that the United States is poised on the brink of using Tomahawk cruise missiles against Syria, which could kill more people than all the people killed in the alleged gas attacks attributed to the Syrian military without proof.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is just it's absurd.
Yeah. Well, certainly you're sounding the alarm in the sense that we have to break up this hegemony that you refer to, the Gramsci point, that doesn't permit us to say, well, can we go by international law? Can the Canadian government, for example, go to the United Nations and discuss with equal parties how these things can be resolved? Everything is turned into a cowboy movie.
Mm-hmm. It has.
I noticed, by the way, I just want to invoke a name here. I see that Angela Kane is a UN disarmament person. I think she's in Damascus, by the way. I'm struck by these people's background. She was educated in American universities, which means that she's okay. And her last job before being going to UN was she worked for the World Bank. The apples don't fall far from the tree.
It's the right credentials.
Yes. She's the kind of person you could trust, I suppose.
That's kind of like a misnomer calling her U.S. disarmament ambassador. It's Every other country disarms but the U.S. ambassador, you mean?
Yes. Yeah, the ambassador in charge of disarming foreign states. Yes. Well, Stephen, it's great to talk to you. We didn't get you to quote James Brown today, but we tried. Those are great articles. It's gowans.wordpress.com. Thank you very, very much.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, bye-bye. That's Stephen Gowans, and I cannot recommend him highly enough.
You know, Phil, that while Stephen Harper was on the phone, or at least the Toronto Star says he was.
He thought he was on the phone.
Yeah, he thought he was
may
on
not
the
have been
he
on the
Yeah,
phone.
He was talking to a fraudster there. But, you know, two old war lovers from an earlier government era, Alan Rock and Lloyd Axworthy, chimed in today, and they wrote a piece in the Globe and Mail on the website saying, we should do what we did in Kosovo. Never mind the Russians acting out of self-interest, the Security Council. He said, you know, we bombed Kosovo, and then Milosevic had to come to The Hague and answer for his crimes. And I thought, these are two lawyers writing this thing. Of course, Milosevic was never convicted of any crimes.
He was never convicted, that's right.
And of course, what they did in Kosovo, as I recall, is they bombed heavily urbanized populations in Belgrade, yes. Killed a lot more people than anybody has claimed has been killed in Damascus.
Yes, and Mr. Axworthy forgets that he's standing in the shadow of a larger beast, and he's saying, we.
Yeah.
He didn't do any of that. NATO, with its muscle-bound and use of steroids, it beat the hell out of somebody, but Lloyd didn't do any of that. Lloyd ought to learn something, but unlikely is not one of my favorite people. This is a Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. You can write to us, taylor@ciut.fm, and we're on the web at taylor-report.com. And just in the closing moments here, a few other detailed points I want to make sure we say about. We talked about this Washington March. There's a new film, and Phil, you saw it, the Jackie Robinson story, right?
I haven't seen it.
I
didn't want to go because the more I read about it, the more I said I don't want to see it.
Yeah, it's interesting, and because I was on a plane, I saw it. See, that was part of the deal. Yeah. I get to watch the movie. I didn't get a sandwich, but I got to watch the movie. So if I couldn't hear my stomach. Jackie Robinson was at the March on Washington.
Yes, he was.
And I didn't know that till I read the speech given just a couple days ago by Jesse Jackson. And I highly recommend that speech because Jesse Jackson's got a wonderful, of course, way of expressing himself, but also he's got a sense of duty to history. He names a lot of people who everyone has forgotten about, or many have forgotten about. I saw Julian Bond mentioned that also Sammy Davis Jr. was there, and he had a very nice memory. He said, I was given, Baird Rustin gave me the job of passing out fresh Coca-Colas to celebrities. So he said, I had the pleasure of walking up to Sammy Davis Jr., and he pretended he had a pistol and said, thanks, kid. So everybody gets this. But that does tell you. Let's remember, Walter Reuther was there of the AFL-CIO and the auto workers. That was a very smart demonstration, well-organized, and it was open, inclusive, and it was about more than simply the question of racial oppression, but it was also about the solutions.
Well, it was the March on Washington for jobs and freedom.
Jobs.
That's what it was, jobs and freedom. The word jobs came before freedom.
Yes.
The March on Washington for jobs and freedom.
Well, Martin Luther King used that phrase, which he said, well, okay, now we're at the lunch counter, but we can't afford to buy the food. Kind of important, you might say. Well, you've been listening to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. Again, Jim Dannon's book, Challenging the Mississippi Firebombers. You can get it at
Baraka Books.
Baraka Books and a bookstore on Bathurst.
A different book list.
I know these things unless I have to say them immediately on the air. Terry, thanks very much. And for Phil Connor, Phil Taylor, we'll see you next week.